Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. With me in the studio is my wonderful producer, Mr. Dan Arnfeld. Good afternoon, Dan.
Hello.
So good to have Dan back. And we've all survived the 4th of July weekend, and that's a great thing. And here at the campus, we're in the summer camp. We've got all kinds of kids running all over camp. And, of course, a lot of the employees here are helping out with softball and basketball and all kinds of stuff that is going on. And so this year they decided to use army tents. So we've got army tents all over campus. And all the young people want a fire pit. And my son-in-law is he's over the building and grounds. And he said, no fire pits. He said, unless he can get canister ones that they can keep the flames down. So it is quite warm in Oklahoma. It's Oklahoma summer. But one thing that's really amazing is the nights are really cool. And so being in the tents, they have the big army tents and the flaps open up. So they're nice and cool at night. So anyway, I don't have any comments written in today. And, of course, I'll forgive everybody out there because it was the 4th of July weekend and things like that. But when my daughter and her husband were certainly the lead adults in the Celtic Throne Tour out west, and there's a lot of people out there that when they found out whose daughter she was, they started talking to her about, well, how much we like Shakespeare. So I hope everybody starts liking JBL just as much because both are great programs. And in fact, I have a couple of companies have contacted me recently. They would like to feature JBL and the Shakespeare's education, Royal Education. They want to feature them in an encyclopedia of podcasts. And so I don't know what that means. I don't know how much it costs. And I don't know if it'll really give me to an advantage or not. But they are saying that both programs are great for homeschoolers and the young people that are doing their schooling at home. They said they'd be great for them. So that's what we're really trying to do with these anyway. So now we are in JBL, Just the Best Literature. So on our last program, I did complete chapter 3, titled The Scion, but I also began to briefly discuss chapter 4, titled Blowing the Trumpet. And in some ways, it's a little bit of an unusual title for the chapter, and we're going to get into that today. So for today's podcast, I want to begin to show you the significance of chapter 4 in part 1. Now remember, part 1 is called Pushful the Younger, and in some ways, Pushful the Younger does show certainly Winston Churchill's attitude after he left the army. He was going to push himself everywhere, and of course, in the last podcast, we found out that did not work out for him. So, chapter 4 is one thing I want to say about it. This chapter really is the introduction of the details of Churchill's growing rise to great leadership and his involvement in the Boer War. So within a few more podcasts, we're going to be into the middle of the Boer War as well. And I think a lot of people are waiting for that. And so even though things did not go well for him in Oldham, we know from my early life that he is pushful. He's still Pushful the Younger. So remember this. Now remember, part one is titled Pushful the Younger, which is a great description of Winston Churchill's attitude toward politics after leaving the army. Now, previously, we learned that Winston believed that he would be called upon to do great things in politics. So if you have your book, and you don't have to do it right now, but you can go back and review page 30. And on that page, Miss Miller does tell us that Winston wrote his cousin Sonny, and this is what he wrote to his cousin. "Personally, I am very popular here. I am always received with greatest enthusiasm. Winston wrote another friend. I improve every time. At each meeting, I am conscious of growing powers." So there's the pushful part of him. And he's really believed in himself. But honestly, for me, it is sad to say that Winston brutally lost being elected to a political office in Oldham, England. I mean, it was brutal. And he was severely criticized for his loss. And basically because some of the older cronies, I'll call them that. I'm sure he would like to have called them that. Some of the older cronies felt like he didn't stand up to his dad's reputation. And so we'll talk about this a little bit more as we go through this. Now, with that said, let's now continue with chapter 4 titled Blowing the Trumpet. Let's go to page 37. So if you're out there, if you have your book with you, I just want to read a few things from page 37. And this whole chapter titled Blowing the Trumpet is, again, you have to read the whole chapter to really understand essentially what's going on is Churchill still wants to blow the trumpet and have everyone notice him. Basically, it's it. So here's what Miss Millard says. Said if Churchill was looking for a refuge where he might for a time forget his failure, even escape the relentless demands of his own ambition, he should not have returned to the place of his birth, Blenheim Palace. That was a big mistake. And it only made life worse for him. So you know, she starts out, and when I first read that, I thought, I don't know if I agree with her or not. But now I've changed my mind. I've gone back and read this several times. She goes on to say, soon after the election, with no home of his own, no real plan, he traveled to the small town of Woodstock in Oxfordshire, where his family estate sprawled in ornate splendor across 7 acres of a vast 2,000-acre park. Now, I have had the wonderful occasion to have visited Blenheim myself, and I took a tour of everything. I took a tour of the land. It was just unbelievable. I was inside Blenheim for a couple hours, and it is an amazing, amazing structure. And there's a lot of history to it. We're not going to get into necessarily all of that right away today, because we're going to extend this program to probably an hour just to help me cover this for a lot of you, and then you won't get mad at me because I'm not covering enough at the same time. Anyway, she said that this was like the worst thing that he could do. Now let's just go ahead and we'll skip over to page 38, and let's go down to the bottom of the page. Here's another thing what she said, I think it really does reveal a lot about Churchill himself. So if we go to the bottom of page 38, let me just read what she says. She goes on to talk about why this was such a painful reminder of his inability thus far to live up to what he had grown up. I mean, he was born at Blenheim. He didn't live there all the time, but he had been he had spent a lot of time there in the summers, and he knew about the history of his great ancestor, John Churchill. She goes on to write here, says, everything Churchill saw as he walked the broad, seemingly endless corridors of Blenheim, everything he admired, everything he was determined to become, was inescapably linked to his illustrious ancestor, John Churchill, the first Duke of Marlborough. John Churchill, whose own father had been a man of much more modest means, had won his grand estate through his own courage and hard-edged intelligence. Although he had fallen into and out of favor with every ruler of England from King James II, whom he had at first supported and then helped to depose, to William of Orange, to Queen Anne, and had even been imprisoned in the Tower of London, he had one skill that made him indispensable. He never lost on the battlefield. And so that is the history of John Churchill. And of course, she goes on to tell us that the whole time he's at Blenheim, he's facing a big oil paintings of John Churchill. If he goes out on the grounds, there's statues of John Churchill, and he's been portrayed in Romanesque clothes from the Roman Empire, and there's eagles at his feet. And I think we learned about Winston Churchill, he thought he was pretty tough. He thought he had everything to get into politics, and it was a horrendous failure. Anyway, the thing about his famous ancestor is that it says here, he had one skill that made him indispensable. He never lost on the battlefield. Amid all the chances and baffling accidents of war, he produced victory with almost mechanical certainty. Winston would write in his biography of John Churchill more than 30 years later, he never rode off any field except as a victor. He quitted war invincible, and no sooner was his guiding hand withdrawn than disaster overtook the armies he had left. And so in other words, he was a quitted warrior. That's what he wanted to do. And Winston actually saw himself, as a quitted warrior. I mean, he thought he was walking in the footsteps of his great ancestors. And it wasn't true. And he had to learn a really, really important lesson. Now, if we go over to page 39, and we'll just read at the middle of the page, it says, nearly 200 years later, and this is the time when Churchill is there. In other words, 200 years later after John Churchill was alive. And he said, the weight of John Churchill's legacy followed his ambitions, his ambitious young descendant wherever he went. If Winston entered the Great Hall, his shoes echoing on the marble floors, an elaborate mural depicting the first Duke kneeling before Britannia, that was, Britain was called Britannia, unfurling his grand plan for the Battle of Blenheim, loomed above him from the room's breathtaking 67-foot-high ceiling. If he wandered into the green writing room, whose walls were covered in a rich green silk damask, he was confronted by an enormous, incredibly detailed tapestry depicting John Churchill's triumph at Blenheim. If he escaped the palace to stroll across the enormous park with its arboretum, vast lake, and elaborate themed gardens, the Italian and the rose, he could see from almost any direction the column of victory, a soaring Doric column that loomed over the grounds and lifted 134 feet into the sky, a statue of the first Duke, clothed as a Roman general, two proud eagles at his feet, and a winged victory held aloft in his hand. So here, the whole time he's at Blenheim, it's Winston Churchill had to face, he's a failure. No matter what room he went into, hey, dude, you're a failure. And it really didn't work as well for him as maybe he thought. She goes on to say, John Churchill had been 54 years old before the Battle of Blenheim, but Winston refused to accept his own youth as an excuse for inaction. His father had been a member of Parliament. I'm over to page 40 now, at 25, barely a year older than Churchill was now. Earlier in that year, before Winston had even asked to run for the Parliament, Lord Salisbury had appointed Sonny, who was just 3 years older than Winston, paymaster general. So here, even his cousin Sonny gets into politics, just walks right in. He thinks, well, I could get in. And he says Sonny, in fact, had a political career for 7 years after inheriting his title and accompanying seat in the House of Lords from his father, who, like Winston's, had died an early death. She goes on to write, says, you are young to be in the ministry. Churchill had congratulated Sonny after his appointment. So, yeah, he's kind of mad. You're so young to be in the ministry. What are you doing? He said, but this is an age of youth, so accept my tribute not only as coming from a friend, but from one of the generation that has yet to divide the world. Now, that's pretty arrogant. I mean, he's telling, hey, Sonny, we're the youth. We're going to divide this world. You know, we're going to rule it. And there's a lot of woke people that think that way today, you know, even in America. So again, this is still page 40. And this is really a key paragraph for everybody out there to realize that Winston was smart enough to come to himself and to face reality. It says, although Churchill believed that his youth was an advantage that it would be foolish to squander, the constant reminders at Blenheim of the first Duke's extraordinary achievements could not help but serve as a stark lesson. And the lesson was, he had leaped too soon. That's the lesson. He needed to learn it. By running for Parliament on the strength of his father's name rather than his own, Churchill had made a serious miscalculation. And this is a quote, "It is a fine game to play, the game of politics," he had written his mother from India, "and it is well worth waiting for a good hand before really plunging." This time, as desperate as he was to dive back in, he was determined to take his own advice and distinguish himself first. All he needed was an opportunity. All he needed was another war. And so we've already discussed all of this in my early life. Winston had this desire to have the limelight, and any chance he could get it, he was going to grab it. And so he lost Oldham, but now he said, I got to find another war, because he wanted to build himself on himself. And in some ways, you know, he was really trying to hold on to his dad's, you know, how would you say it? Maybe his dad's suspenders or his dad's coattails. But that was the wrong thing to do. He needed to be himself. And that's what he began to realize. All right. She goes on to say, before the summer was out, Churchill would not only find the spark he needed to begin again, he would fan the flames himself. The idea would come in not in the hallowed halls of Parliament or the stately rooms of Blenheim Palace, but on a boat adrift in the slow-moving waters of the Thames. And so if you can remember back to my early life, there's a lot of times that things just fell into his lap. You know, he was trying to hunt for things, but they would fall in his lap. And so he knew he needed a new opportunity, and all of a sudden it falls in his lap. And here it comes. She goes on to say, in late July, Churchill received an invitation to a dinner party at the riverside home of his friend, Lady June. It was an invitation that no one, not even those in Churchill's rarefied social sphere, would ever refuse. Although the widow of a colonel and the wife of a barrister, Lady June, owned her fame not to her husband's titles or achievements, but to her own sparkling intellect. Known for the sharp mind and quick wit, she wrote for some of the most prestigious society journals of the day and was one of the most formidable hostesses in London, drawing to her the greatest minds in the empire. Her gatherings were famous and frequent, and a place on her guest list, which included everyone from Thomas Hardy to Robert Browning to even Mrs. Robinson's devoted client, Oscar Wilde. Now, if you forgot who Mrs. Robinson was, remember, she's the palm reader. And so Oscar Wilde was a famous poet, and also he wrote great plays. And she goes on to say it was nearly as coveted as an invitation to Buckingham Palace. So if you were invited to Lady June's house, it was like going to Buckingham Palace. Says, an introduction to her became a passport to many social privileges. A contemporary American writer would recall, her intellectual and political influence was as great as the charm which made her salon so brilliant. So here, you know, Churchill he's crying. He's tired of looking at his famous ancestor. And he knows he needs another war. And all of a sudden, Lady June pops up. And she's got all kinds of political figures, you know, running around. So anyway, Churchill knew, this is the paragraph, this is page 41 now, Churchill knew that by attending one of Lady June's gatherings, he was certain to meet someone interesting and quite possibly useful. He might not, I mean, he liked to use people. He said, well, I can find someone useful. He might not have been surprised, therefore, but he was certainly thrilled when soon after arriving at her home, he stepped onto a launch for the afternoon cruise on the Thames and found none other than Joseph Chamberlain, Secretary of State for the Colonies and one of Britain's most powerful politicians. Churchill, what did he do? Did he just wait in the wings? No. Churchill quickly took a seat next to him, and the two men were soon lost in conversation. So, if you want a vision or you want to really pick good picture of Winston Churchill as a young man, that's it. You know, he is going to do anything he can to get forward. And so it's just amazing. She goes on to say, had he been delivering a lecture to a crowded amphitheater, Chamberlain could not have had a more eager audience than he had in Churchill alone. So you can just see Churchill just sucked up everything this guy was saying. His conversation was a practical political education in itself, Churchill would later recall. He knew every detail, every turn, and the twist of the game. Chamberlain also knew how to fight, although apparently not when to lay down arms. A radical politician and a fierce competitor who had worked his way up through the narrow British hierarchy from his father's shoe factory to mayor of Birmingham to Parliament, he kept careful track of his grudges, even those that had long since ceased to be a threat. So, I mean, Mr. Chamberlain, he went through a tough time. And, his problem was he carried grudges against people that picked on him. Candace goes on and says, when Lady June pointed out in surprise an old political enemy of Chamberlain's, who happened to be sitting in a chair near the river as they glided by, Churchill was astonished by Chamberlain's reaction. The famously dignified man, often caricatured for his carefully combed hair, long patrician face, and glinting monocle that trailed a silky ribbon down his cheek, glared at his now elderly and harmless rival and spat a bundle of old rags before turning away in disgust. So this guy spits on the boat when he sees an old guy who used to be one of his rivals. And Churchill was shocked by that. He was really shocked. So you can see that Churchill wasn't going to hold, a lot of envy and things against people. She goes on to say, what was foremost on the minds of both Chamberlain and Churchill that afternoon, however, was not old disputes, but the shadow of a new one. There had been whispers of war, a war unlike anything the empire had seen since the Crimean War nearly a half a century earlier, perhaps even the American Revolution more than 100 years in the past. This war, however, was brewing not in Eastern Europe or North America, but in Southern Africa, thousands of miles away in a part of the world that was difficult to reach and almost impossible to fully understand. Nor was it simply the threat of another colonial war to add to the scores of others taking place at the moment around the globe. This would be a European war on African soil, a prospect that seemed almost Britain's to be far less terrifying than tantalizing. So they didn't see going to South Africa as something terrifying. They just were tantalized. And she's going to explain why in just a minute here. She says, and a few hoped it would be averted, at least of all Winston Churchill. So there are some people who did not want the war, but Winston and Mr. Chamberlain definitely wanted war. And so it's not surprising. So we know what Churchill's plan is. He wants to get the front row and be famous. She goes on to say, although Southern Africa had been an object of great interest to the British Empire for centuries, more recently the allure had turned to lust. Perfectly positioned as it was, the region had long been a critical link in the trade route to India, which led British ships down the jutting western coast of Africa, around the Cape of Good Hope, where they would stop for supplies before heading back north up the eastern coast, past the Horn of Africa into the Indian Ocean. The British had colonized the southern tip of the continent, and of course they called it Cape Colony, as well as Sierra Leone to the west, parts of Nigeria just under the chin of Africa, Zanzibar to the east, and the Suez Canal Zone in the north. For many years, that had been enough. Now, if you look at this history, a lot of people could, have a bad attitude about England. But if you look at Africa today, and if you look at a country like Russia, they've already seized a lot of land in Africa. I think even Germany and Europe, they want parts of Africa. And because they want to be near the Mediterranean Sea, you know, they want to be near the Suez Canal. And so big nations, you know, want to have an advantage when they feel like they need it. So we can't point our fingers at England saying, why did you do this in Africa? Now, it says just 7 years before Churchill was born, however, everything had changed. And this is good history to get us ready for the Boer War. And this is why I think this chapter is so important. So just 7 years before Churchill was born, however, everything had changed. In 1867, Erasmus Jacobs, the 15-year-old son of a South African farmer, is said to have sat down to rest beneath a tree on his father's farm and found an extremely large and shiny stone lying at his feet. The stone turned out to be a 21.25-carat diamond, later known as the Eureka Diamond, the first diamond ever discovered in South Africa. So not only was South Africa geographically important for the English, the South Africa became, how do you say it, financially, very, very exciting for England as well. It says, 4 years later, more diamonds were found not far from the Jacobus home on the farm of two brothers named Johann and Nicholas Diedrich Ardelos de Beer. And so all of you people out there that are really familiar with diamonds, the De Beer diamonds are still very expensive today. And Americans like De Beer diamonds too. So we pay for them. We don't go to war for them, but we pay for them. Anyway, it was a discovery that would lead to the formation of the De Beers SA, the largest diamond company in the world. But that wasn't it. All right. So here's the next big thing. Then came the gold. About two decades after the Eureka Diamond was discovered, the world's largest known gold reserve was found in the Witwatersrand mountain ridge. The tiny, filthy camp that sprouted up around the mine quickly became flooded with fortune seekers and eventually grew to become one of South Africa's largest and most important cities, Johannesburg. And so Dan, have you been in South Africa? Have you been there? Have you been to Johannesburg?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. It's been a long time. I was there in 2003.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know that some of the brethren there would really like us to come over. And so far, I want to stay as close as I can to America. So you never know what's going to happen in the world. But anyway, I know Johannesburg is supposedly absolutely beautiful. It says, together, these discoveries transformed the region from one of the poorest in the world to one of the wealthiest. As is often true, this is still page 43 now, as is often true, with great wealth came great trouble. As Churchill put it, the discovery of an El Dorado had attracted a vast and various swarm of humanity. Tens of thousands of prospectors descended on the region, the great majority of whom were British. The problem was that neither the gold nor the diamonds had been discovered in British territory. They had been found in the Southern African Republic, also known as the Transvaal, an independent country that belonged to a group of Dutch, German, and Huguenot descendants known as the Boers. So all these things did not happen in the English colony over there. But the English wanted it. And so she goes on, Candace goes on to say, a deeply religious, stubbornly independent people, the Boers wanted above all else to be left alone. Many of them could trace their ancestry back to the members of a Dutch East India Company expedition who had sailed to the Cape of Good Hope in 1652 to establish a shipping station and decided to stay. So that is, before the American Revolution. You know, this was all going on with England and Germany and the Boers and the Dutch and all that. So it says, when the Cape Colony became a British possession in 1806, they had grudgingly submitted to British rule, but not for long. So when the British came in, they established Cape Colony, and they demanded that they rule that area. And it says, after centuries of devastating entire populations of native Africans and taking over vast swaths of their land, much like the Pilgrims and pioneers in North America, the Boers were furious when the British Empire abolished slavery in 1833, just 2 years later in what would become known as the Great Trek. Large groups of Boers called Voortrekkers, or pioneers, left Cape Colony and began pushing their way hundreds of miles into the African interior, eventually establishing three Boer republics, the Orange Free State, the Republic of Natalia, later Natal, and the Transvaal. The Boers' independence, however, had lasted only as long as their poverty. This gold, Paul Kruger, who would become president of the Transvaal, had predicted, will cause our country to be soaked in blood. And so you got some bloodthirsty people out there that wanted the gold and the diamonds. He was right, and he knew well the dangers it posed. 10 years after the discovery of diamonds, Britain had annexed the Transvaal, a move that infuriated the Boers and quickly led to the Transvaal War, later known as the First Boer War. Although the war had lasted only a few months from the end of 1880 to the early spring of 1881, it held a prominent place in the collective memories of both countries for one reason. The British Empire did not win. They didn't win. So the turning point of the Transvaal War had been the Battle of Majuba Hill, which ended not with the Union Jack triumphantly planted on Boer soil, but with the shocking, sickening sight of British soldiers fleeing in humiliating retreat. For the Boers, the day of the battle, February 27th, had become a national holiday. For the British, it was a searing memory, one that they vowed to repay. Even Churchill, who had been then only 6 years old at the time, hungered for revenge. I long for the day, he wrote, on which we should avenge Majuba. So can you believe that this could stick in people's mind for so long? You know, they're just after each other. All right, so we'll continue now on page 44. And again, we're still in chapter 4. And I just want you to see that Miss Miller does a great job of preparing us for the Boer War. She gives us history before we start reading about it. And it's really great. And it says, the day Churchill now believed had not only come, it was long overdue. He fiercely defended the importance, even the benevolence, of British imperialism, and he had been brooding over the problem of South Africa for years. So, Churchill wants a war, and I actually have titled this program, The Scion Wants a War. that's what's going on. And he said, the more he thought about it, the more certain he was the war was the only answer. It is not yet too late to recover our vanished prestige in South Africa, he had written 2 years earlier in a treatise titled Our Account with the Boers. Imperial troops must curb the insolence of the Boers. There must be no half measures. As he continued his conversation with Chamberlain over dinner at Lady June's home following their cruise on the Thames, Churchill did not try to hide or even temper his belief that the Empire should take a hard line with the Boers. Chamberlain, he knew, had a long history with the Transvaal, and none of it was good. He had been Prime Minister William Gladstone's lieutenant in the House of Commons during the Transvaal War, an experience that had left him with an undistinguished loathing of the Boers. Then at the end of 1895, in the first year of his tenure as Secretary of State for the Colonies, he had been tied to an ill-conceived and spectacularly failed on the Transvaal, concocted by the mining magnate Cecil Rhodes and led by his closest friend, lender Stuart Jameson. What became known as the Jameson Raid had ended with Jameson's capture and Rhodes' forced resignation as Prime Minister of Cape Colony. Rhodes had narrowly escaped imprisonment and the raid, as well as Chamberlain's involvement in it, had been splashed across the front pages of every newspaper in England and South Africa, and had led to a parliamentary investigation of Chamberlain himself. And so you can see that this war with South Africa had gone on for a long time. Even Chamberlain, though he could not forgive an old political slight, much less a humiliating scandal that could have destroyed his career, was taken aback by Churchill's fervor for war. So this is all happening on this boat on the Thames. And so, I mean, Winston is not at all bashful, telling him, we need to get in there and beat the Boers up. You know, that's what he's saying. And Chamberlain was just shocked that here's this young man who just lost, an election. He wants to go back, to a war. It said Chamberlain had warned the House of Commons after the raid on the Transvaal 3 years earlier, it would be a long war, a bitter war, and a costly war. It would leave behind it the embers of a strife which I believe generations would hardly be long enough to extinguish. After listening to Churchill's passionate argument for war with the Boers, Chamberlain advised him to resist the urge to call for arms. It is no use blowing the trumpet for the charge, he warned, and then looking around to find nobody following you. So that is the title of the book, this chapter, blowing the trumpet. And here, Winston Churchill, the young Winston Churchill, is getting absolutely incredible teaching and about war. Chamberlain is really, really working hard to help him. Now, Candace goes on to say, the last thing that Churchill was worried about, however, was finding followers. Although he was only 24 years old, he was already confident of his ability to stir the hearts of men. And where the Boers were concerned, he was not about to back down, not when there was so much to be gained. Sooner or later, he had written in Our Account with the Boers, in a righteous cause or a pit quarrel, where the approval of Europe or the teeth of Germany, for the sake of our empire, for the sake of our honor, for the sake of the race, we must fight the Boers. So even Winston Churchill understood, not only was he dealing with the people of South Africa, they were going to be dealing with Germany. If you think about his history, he was fighting Germany in World War I and World War II as well. So there's a lot of history here. All right, let's skip down to skip down one more paragraph on page 46. So hopefully you're able to follow me here. And we still got enough time that maybe we can even finish this whole chapter. So here Candace tells us that within just a few weeks of Lady June's dinner party, Churchill stood at the imposing pillared entrance of Blenheim Palace, surrounded this time not by just tributes to the first Duke of Marlborough, but by an eager audience of hundreds, and heedless of Chamberlain's advice, made his case for war. So he goes back to Blenheim, if you can get this over, invites hundreds of people in, and he starts trying to convince them why we need the Boer War. So what happened to politics? He said, I need to find a war. His opportunity had come to the annual meeting of the Woodstock Conservative Association following a day of festivities that included everything from a ladies' bicycle race over the palace grounds to a potato-picking race in one of the gardens to an obstacle course that ended with the exhausted challengers shakingly trying to thread a needle. At 6 p.m., long before the summer sun had begun to set, the association's members gathered at the foot of the palace's broad stone steps to hear the remarks of the ninth Duke of Marlborough, as well as two of his cousins, the calm, dark, and ivory guest who was the son of Lady Cornelia, Randolph Churchill's older sister, and guest popular opposite the fair-haired and forceful Winston Churchill. So of these people, they were having a great time, and now they're being called to a political meeting. As soon as Sonny, now Sonny was the one cousin, he's the ninth Duke of Marlborough. So as soon as Sonny had finished his perfunctory welcome, but before Ivor Guest, with his thick black mustache, sharply twisted at the ends, could deliver his brief remarks, Winston took the stage. So he jumped ahead. As his audience stood patiently in the blazing August heat, he wasted little time getting to the subject that he believed had the greatest power to affect the empire's future, not to mention his own. So see, Candace is pretty smart. He knew what he was doing. He wanted to get himself, a future, a great future position. He said, I'll stay with that, not to mention his own South Africa. Nor did he temper his remarks with a single note of caution. On the contrary, as the reporters attending the event noted with growing alarm, he was unabashedly beating the drum of war. Again, did he really learn? Did he learn a lot? It said, inspired possibly by memories of the great warrior, the founder of his house, he was in a warlike vein. A reporter for the Manchester Evening News wrote of Churchill. So now he's not being associated with his father. He's being associated with John, his warrior ancestor. Said the present condition of things could not go on indefinitely without war breaking out, he said, and he was not sure that the prospect of war was very terrible or one to be trembled at. England, after all, was a very great power, Churchill reminded his rapt audience, and the Boers were a very small and miserable people. So I think the Boers had proved themselves a little bit, that they weren't to be messed with. It says, while Churchill's audience was swept up in his speech, laughing at his jokes and cheering at his energetic declarations, many of the reporters in the crowd were astonished by the force of his argument and deeply concerned by his powers of persuasion. If he would encourage the political supporters of Mr. Chamberlain to enter upon war in a cavalier fashion, careless of the amount of sufferings and misery it causes because they know that we are strong and the Boers are weak, one reporter railed, he commits himself to a course of action which is highly reprehensible. So he's not doing himself a big favor. He also guessed that Churchill's motives, like the most of his famous ancestor, were not entirely pure. The first Duke of Marlborough was more than suspected of bringing about a great battle in the hope that the victory he was pretty sure to obtain would restore his popularity, the reporter charged. Fortunately, he wrote, in a more enlightened age, Churchill's radical point of view finds no advocates outside the ranks of the young aristocracy. And so here the Duke of Marlborough had this war so he could look better in people's eyes. What is Churchill doing? Trying to look better in people's eyes. So in this last pronouncement, however, the reporter could not have been more mistaken. Churchill was far from alone in his desire to take on the Boers. Nor on this issue, at least, was there any class divide. In fact, the British people seemed not following the charge to war, but leading it. Not only did they still feel sharply the sting of Majuba, but most had never experienced what they considered to be a real war, a civilized war, between men of European descent, and the idea was electric. As the summer began to fade, England's interest in South Africa and its excitement over the possibility of war only grew in strength. The atmosphere Churchill would still remember years later gradually but steadily became tense, charged with electricity, laden with the presage of storm. And so it is amazing to me, as we go through this and understand it, here, Churchill loses, a great opportunity to be elected into politics. And then he gets depressed for a while, but then he really pops up on top almost immediately. It's just amazing. And so he did have an incredible personality, but he did have great understanding. You know, and the thing is he really believed in empire. And it's not so much that they were just going to bully people around the world, but he believed the empire could help people. And that the empire could help the South African, I mean, the natives. It could help them as well. And, I mean, the Boers, I mean, they came in and just took land away from the natives. You know, so it's not like they were the righteous people. But it is interesting that you know, he did have a warrior spirit like his ancestor, John. He said, the atmosphere there, however, was one not of exhilaration, but of grim determination. The thousands of Britons who had flooded the Transvaal were now demanding not just a share in the country's riches, but an equal vote and a voice in its government. The British Empire, meanwhile, had begun amassing troops at the Transvaal borders and claiming large swaths of territory in southern Africa, as well as Cape Colony, which had taken in 1806 during the Napoleonic Wars, and the former Boer Republic of Natalia, which it had annexed in 1843. It began surrounding the country to the west, north, and southeast, effectively cutting it off from the sea. Finally, on October 9th, driven by fear and fury, the Boers issued an ultimatum to the British Empire. Stand down or prepare for war. The government must press for an immediate and affirmative answer before Wednesday, October 11th, 1899, not later than 5 o'clock p.m., read the ultimatum, which had been telegraphed to London from the Transvaal capital of Pretoria. So you can look now that it was the Boers, it was everybody in South Africa, they were now challenging England. Say, okay, here's the challenge. You got to answer us by this time. And it came right out of Pretoria. It desires further to add that in the event of unexpectedly no satisfactory answer being received by it within that interval, it will, with great regret, be compelled to regard the action of Her Majesty's government as a formal declaration of war. So in many ways, I guess what the people in South Africa, they wanted, you know, to discuss this, do we need this war? But if you don't answer us, then we're assuming this is a declaration of war. It says the British allowed the deadline for the ultimatum to pass with little more than a sneer. At 3 p.m. on October 11th, just 2 hours before the deadline, William Conyngham Green, Her Majesty's agent at Pretoria, received a telegram from London, which he brought immediately to the President of the Transvaal, Paul Kruger, and his Secretary of State for War, Louis de Souza. After reading the telegram, which dismissed its government claims out of hand and refused to abide by its terms, Kruger, a large man with a wide, solemn face, ringed by a gray chin, curtain beard, sat for a long time without saying a word, filling the nearly empty room with a heavy silence. Finally, bowing his head, he said simply, "So must it be. We have crossed the Rubicon," D'Souza's wife, Marie, wrote in her diary that night, "and God knows the end of it all." Churchill had gotten his wish. England was going to war, and the bloody war-torn 20th century was about to begin. The age of peace had ended. Churchill would write years later, looking back on this moment from the vantage of a man who had witnessed the horrors of the world war and was about to endure those of another. There was to be no lack of war. There was to be enough for all. Aye, enough and to spare. And so there we are. We finished this chapter 4. And Churchill has got his war. Now, if you look at part 2, it's titled Into Africa. And what I want to do is I'll just mention a little bit about this today, but we'll get into this in the next podcast that we have. But so we would be done with part 1, Pushful the Younger. And again, we're going to now get into Africa. And then at the beginning of chapter 5, it says, Send Her Victorious is the title. It says, 3 days after war was declared, Churchill, now a journalist, was at the port of Southampton on England's southern coast, fighting his way through a massive crowd toward a ship, the Dunottar Castle, known as the gateway to the Empire. Southampton had been used as a port since the Middle Ages. The Mayflower and its sister ship, the Speedwell, had set sail from there for the New World in 1620, and in just a few years, the RMS Titanic would do the same. Southampton, however, was best known as the port from which England had sent its young men into battle since 1415, when Henry V had left to fight the French at the Battle of Agincourt. And so this Southampton pier, I guess you could call it, a shipping port. There's so many things, have happened from there. And even Henry V, we are going to be covering in our Shakespeare series, we are going to be covering Henry V in that podcast as well. It goes on to say here, although England had been engaged in countless conflicts in the nearly 500 years since Agincourt, it had been a long time since Southampton had seen such frenzied excitement accompanying the commencement of war. Since early that morning, the port had been choked with thousands of people breathlessly awaiting the arrival of Sir Redvers Buller, the new appointed commander-in-chief of Her Majesty's Army in South Africa. In fact, they had arrived at the port well before Buller had even reached Waterloo Station, where he had been given a grand send-off from London earlier that afternoon by the Prince of Wales. While Southampton continued to fill with eagle revelers, men's silk hats gleaming in the damp, salty air, women's long layered dresses sweeping the ground, their hems already stained a stubborn black, the corpulent prince had been clapping Buller on the back, muttering, "Goodbye, goodbye, wish you jolly good luck." And so essentially, England is now really ready for war. They want to have war. And, Churchill had his part in it, which is really, really amazing. He said, when Buller's special five-car train, its interior upholstered in a rich yellow silk, finally reached the port at 3:47 p.m., the long, low stream whistle announced his arrival was immediately swallowed by the deafening roar of the crowd. Those had resorted to sitting on everything from packing crates and cast-aside boxes to the port's filthy ground during their long wait leaped to their feet, cheering wildly. A rope that had been strung the 50 yards between the customs house and the ship in an effort to separate passengers from onlookers was straining to its snapping point. Harried policemen, their belted tunics by now wrinkled and stained, and their helmets barely hanging by the chin straps, fought to maintain order. So can you imagine? There's this large crowd at the Southampton port, cheering people on to go fight in South Africa. Even the most desperate attempts to control the crowd proved useless when Buller himself appeared. Although dressed for the chill of an early autumn air, a felt bowler hat covering his strikingly large head, and a dark gray overcoat that was, at one reporter disdainfully noted, not quite new, thrown over his beer-like shoulders, he was absolutely unmistakable. It was as if he looked over the crowd with a benign smile beneath the heavy mustache. He seemed more like a gentleman farmer than the commander of one of the most feared armies in the world. He was loved alone. He was loved nonetheless for it. As he navigated the narrow passageway and carved between the pressing crowds and ascended the steep ramp to the Dunottar Castle, that was the ship, the cheering rose with him, filling the port with voices of thousands. Can you imagine? Thousands of people gathered to see the ship off for war. The ship itself had arrived from the Thames 3 days earlier, 420 feet long and displacing about 5,500 tons. Although it was 10 years old, had recently been renovated, the ladies' waiting room transformed into a sprawling stateroom for Buller. More important, it was fast. The Dunottar Castle could sail at 16 knots per hour, a pace that had dramatically reduced the average travel time between Southampton and Cape Town from a month and a half to just over 2 weeks. Even that was too long for Churchill. This is really funny. You know? He says, too nearly everyone who gazed up at it, the Dunlauter Castle, or Dunlauter Castle with its straight, strong mast, slanting lines of rigging, and elegantly curving bow, was a thing of beauty. To Churchill, it was a sight that made his stomach turn. He had already crossed the ocean many times in his young life, traveling between England, India, Africa, and North America before the invention of the airplane, and he had hated every moment he was forced to spend on a ship. Not once had he avoided becoming violently ill. Even crossing the English Channel was worse than a flogging. He had written to his mother after returning to India from London, and it made him wretched. Churchill would never lose his hatred of traveling by sea. Later in life, quoting Samuel Johnson, he would compare being on a ship to being in prison, only with the chance of being drowned. As much as he dreaded the 2 weeks that stretched before him now, however, he resolutely took his place and in line and solemnly boarded the ship, knowing that whatever misery he was about to endure aboard the Dunlauter Castle, war lay on the other side. So he was just really, really excited that there was going to be war on the other side. Well, that's about all the time we have for today, folks. So I want you to make note of chapter 5, we're going to be continuing with that on our next podcast. So let me get my conclusion in here. I spent a lot of time this morning writing it. It only is fair that I get to read it. So that's all the time we have for today's program. On our next program, we will continue to discuss Candace Millard's book, Hero of the Empire, Part 1. But we're going to move on to Chapter 5. And let me see if I can find the title of that real quickly. Chapter 5, the title is Send Her Victorious. And so hopefully you're enjoying this book, and I just want to say this. This book is a wonderful supplement to Winston Churchill's book, My Early Life, and continues the history of Winston's success in politics and the Boer War. So one of the good things for all of you out there that have been waiting for the Boer War, that will now take up probably all of the discussion as we go on, and that's going to be a very, very exciting part of the book. Now, you can buy a new or used copy of Candace Millard's book at Amazon.com. And I checked Amazon today, and there's more than one copy of used books there. And I'm not using the ABE books anymore because they're having trouble with their people selling there. They're actually ripping people off instead of selling them good books. So we can stay with Amazon there. Now, you may be able to find a good copy in your local bookstore, and of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter @JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.